The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from the Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. And today we're starting with an article entitled Why Politicians Learned to Love the Sales Tax. The combined state and local sales tax has more than doubled since 1970, and Mecklenburg voters are mulling another increase. Why does a tax that hits poor people hardest have so much support? This article is by Jim Morrill. By fall 2020, the Charlotte Moves Task Force was well on its way to putting together a nearly $20 billion plan to meet the city's transportation needs for the next 30 years. There would be rail extensions, including a long-awaited line to North Mecklenburg, as well as road improvements, better bus service, and even an ambitious micro-transit system that uses on-demand vans to fill the gaps. Pieces were falling into place. Except for one, a way to pay for it. That September, the city's chief financial officer presented the group with a long menu of financing choices that included property and sales taxes, revenue bonds, motor vehicle fees, development fees, federal loans, special tax districts, and private money. It's almost like I'm drinking from a fire hose right now, Task Force Chair Harvey Gant told the committee. Lots of options out there, at least in theory. We really didn't consider them, I'll be honest with you, Gant, a Democrat and former mayor, told the Assembly recently. The most equitable tax is the sales tax. So in November, Mecklenburg County voters will be asked to approve a penny sales tax increase projected to raise $19.4 billion over 30 years for transportation improvements. A yes vote would put Mecklenburg County sales tax at 8.25%, the highest in the state. Other municipalities will be watching to see whether a sales tax boost could help with their own transportation challenges. Critics call the sales tax regressive because poor people pay a larger share of their income on it than wealthier people. My concern is the timing of a regressive tax, said former Mayor Jennifer Roberts, a Democrat. The economy is very uncertain. It's a tough time to be asking people to pay more, especially those we know are low income. Advocates like Gant say the trade-off would be more reliable transportation options for people of all income levels. People from outside Mecklenburg would subsidize the investment by contributing a third of the tax revenue, according to the city. Food, medicine, housing, and utilities would be exempt. The referendum faces potential hurdles. The killing of 23-year-old Irina Zarutska on the light rail in August has drawn national attention, including from the White House. It has raised questions of safety and prompted investigations by the state and by the Federal Transit Administration. It triggered a congressional hearing and a special legislative session. The national scrutiny could make some Charlotte residents wary of funding a big expansion of light rail. In a city grappling with gentrification, some voters also are concerned that residents would be displaced by wider roads and development along new rail lines. Others worry about getting a fair share of expected economic opportunities that would come with billions in spending. But according to Gant, few are concerned about the tax itself. Nobody gets in my face about the sales tax, he said. A tax on poverty. North Carolina's state sales tax began in 1933 as a temporary revenue source during the Great Depression. It should be levied with the distinct understanding that it is an emergency measure to save the state's credit and keep going its essential activities, then-Governor John Eringhouse, a Democrat, said. Critics denounced it at the time. The state's revenue commissioner in 1933 said the tax amounted to a tax on poverty, but lawmakers made it permanent in 1939. To raise money for public schools, Governor Terry Sanford extended the sales tax to food in 1961. A quarter century later, GOP Senator Jim Broyhill ran a TV campaign ad criticising food tax Terry Sanford. Sanford won the Senate seat. The General Assembly repealed the food tax in the mid-1990s. In 1971, the General Assembly gave counties authority to levy their own 1 cent sales tax in addition to the 3% state sales tax. Lawmakers allowed that local sales tax to double in the 1980s and then permitted some counties to levy an even higher one. Now, with the state sales tax at 4.75%, the combined state and local sales tax in NC counties ranges from 6.75% to 7.5%. In recent years, North Carolina has cut corporate and personal income taxes, and as a result, the state has become more reliant on the sales tax. In 2000, the state generated 25% of general fund revenues from it. By 2024, that share rose to 34%, which is about the national average. Earlier efforts to raise the sales tax in Mecklenburg have met with mixed success. In 1998, voters approved a half-cent increase for transit. That has paid for the Blue Line light rail, which runs from South Charlotte to the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. In 2007, voters defeated a measure to repeal that tax. 70% of voters voted against repeal, a higher percentage than those who voted for the original tax. But in 2014, voters strongly rejected an effort to raise the tax a quarter cent to fund teacher salaries and support Central Piedmont Community College, as well as the arts. 5 years later, they rejected another proposal to raise the tax a quarter cent for the arts, parks and education. The General Assembly this summer overwhelmingly passed a bill allowing Mecklenburg County to try again to raise the sales tax, this time for the transportation package. If November's referendum passes, the city says a Mecklenburg household with a median annual income of $84,000 would pay an additional $240 a year in taxes, while the average low-income household would pay $132. That's based on calculations that poorer households spend 59% less than the median household on taxable goods. Another way to look at it, according to the Progressive NC Budget and Tax Centre, is that households with poverty-level income now spend 6.6% of their earnings on sales and excise taxes, such as levies on tobacco and alcohol. The top 1% of earners pay just over 1% of their income on those taxes. We know that a sales tax is going to be borne by those who have a fixed income because they spend more of what they have on goods and services, said Alexandra Sirota, executive director of the non-profit. Like any tax, the sales tax has pros and cons. The benefits are that the sales tax is less of a drag on economic growth than corporate and personal income taxes, said Brian Balfour, Senior Vice President for Policy at the Conservative John Locke Foundation. From a revenue perspective, it also has a broad base, unlike the personal income tax, which has a large reduction that excludes many people from paying. The downsides of the sales tax, he said, are that it hits low-income households harder and can give incentives to shoppers to cross into another county for major purchases, which would harm local businesses. The regressive nature of the tax needs to be balanced with better economic and job growth that results from a tax structure more reliant on sales taxes instead of on corporate or personal income taxes, Balfour wrote in an email. State Senator Greg Mayer, an Orange County Democrat, doesn't like sales taxes because of their income impact on low-income people. But he said most people view the sales tax as fair because everyone pays it. It's a transparent tax. You see it on every receipt. And unlike income taxes, sales taxes can't be dodged by people who can afford to hire a savvy accountant. They just want to know that everyone is paying their fair share and I'm not getting screwed, Mayer said. Counting pennies. On a clear Sunday morning in August, Reverend William Barber took to the pulpit at Charlotte's First Baptist Church West. Barber, a former Goldsboro pastor who led the state's Moral Monday protests against the Republican-led legislature, cited other recent tax hikes in criticizing the referendum. "We're not necessarily against a tax," he told congregants. "We're against constantly being taxed in ways that hurt the poor." The campaign to pass the referendum is led by the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance, which is spending $3 million and has hired prominent consultants from both parties. So far, there's been no organized opposition, though individual voices have made themselves heard. Speaking to county commissioners in August, former city council member Braxton Winston, a Democrat, called the proposal a maximal tax that promises minimal returns. Roberts, the former mayor, told commissioners the tax would come as people are losing health care, losing food benefits, losing their jobs. The estimated $132 annual cost may seem like a rounding error if you've got a white-collar job, but if you're a struggling family, that's a huge increase, she said. Community activist Robert Dawkins described supporters as an unholy coalition. Democrats and Republicans have turned into a corporatist on this, he told the Assembly. The fix is in. But Gantz said the benefits for low-income people, as for everyone else, outweigh the costs. He said a better transit system would give them improved service and access to more jobs across the county. Many of them said to me, "You know, we don't mind paying the extra penny. If I can't get to work on time, I lose my job." The influential Black political caucus of Charlotte-Mecklenburg has endorsed the plan. For County Commissioner George Dunlap, a Democrat, it's real simple. "I travel at I-77 and I-85 during certain times of day on a regular basis," he said. "Anybody who gets on the freeway clearly understands the benefit of increasing the sales tax." State Representative Julia Howard, a Davie County Republican and senior chair of the House Finance Committee, was one of the architects of policies a decade ago to cut state income taxes and expand the sales tax to cover some services and events, such as concerts, movies and athletic contests. Howard voted this year to let Mecklenburg put the referendum on the ballot, but she believes an 8.25% sales tax is too high. "If you're looking at people on fixed incomes, I think it will hit those people hard," she said. "They do count the pennies. I feel the angst." On a bright September morning, retired truck driver Daniel Hukeber was leaving a Charlotte Walmart when the Assembly asked him about the referendum. "I'm on a limited income, but a penny, it wouldn't bother me," said Hukeber, 69. "I'm all for anything that can help the traffic in Charlotte right now." Across the parking lot, 80-year-old Effie Exarchus had a different take. "I can't afford it," she said. "Every time I go to the grocery store, the price is up." "I feel the angst," said Mecklenburg Commissioner Arthur Griffin, a Democrat. While he voted with all but one commissioner to put the referendum on the ballot, he still has questions. "All taxes are aggressive for poor people," he said. "What I'm looking for is a balance. What do poor people and rich people get for their investment?" For example, he said, voters see all the developments spurred by Light Rail's Blue Line at the more prosperous areas along South Boulevard. They've also seen the lack of development along the streetcar line, which runs from just east of Uptown up Beatty's Ford Road to less wealthy areas to the west. The streetcar would be extended under the plan. "Unless you're Ray Charles, you can see where the Blue Line has been and is going," he said. "When you look at the streetcar, you've seen the same Beatty's Ford you've seen the last 20 to 30 years. Edwin Peacock is one of only two Republicans on the City Council. "I'm pro-Charlotte," he said, adding that he favours the opportunity to control our transportation choices versus the hope and pray method that Raleigh will allocate enough to us. Limited options. When Gant was mayor in the mid-1980s, he frequently pushed for alternative revenues. He said levies such as a payroll or land transfer tax would take the burden off property and sales taxes. They all failed to get off the ground. He said the need hasn't changed. Sirota of the Budget and Tax Centre said local governments in North Carolina are limited when it comes to raising money. At the local government level, there are really too few options for finding the revenue for community priorities, she said. They're squeezed, and they're squeezed in ways that are unsustainable in the long run. That doesn't surprise Scott Mooneyham, a spokesperson for the NC League of Municipalities. That's something that's always come up, he said, the limited ability of cities and towns to tap any broad array of revenue sources. You've got sales tax and property taxes, and those are the main sources of revenue to pay the operating expenses of cities and towns. Whitney Afonso, who teaches public administration and government at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill's School of Government, said North Carolina is like many states in the options it offers local governments. Afonso said the proposed exemptions in Mecklenburg, including food, medicine and housing, would make the added sales tax less regressive than other sales taxes in the state. And Mecklenburg's position as a border county and tourist destination offers an advantage many counties lack. Charlotte and Mecklenburg benefit tremendously from those non-residents, she said, and that's important to note considering who's bearing the burden of this tax. Only 8% of Charlotte voters went to the polls during September's primary election, but longtime Mecklenburg elections director Michael Dickerson expects a November turnout of 25 to 30%, which would be the highest local election turnout in years. Business North Carolina reported a poll conducted by supporters of the tax in July that showed the referendum winning by slightly more than 50% to 40%, a closer margin than some expected. Roberts, the former mayor, calls it just the wrong plan at the wrong time. But, she said, we know we're David versus Goliath. Well, our next article is about mental health. Cops on ketamine. Largely unregulated mental health treatment faces hurdles. Combining psychotherapy with a low dose of the hallucinogenic drug is a relatively new approach to treating severe depression and post-traumatic stress. The article is by Katya Ritterbusch. A few months ago, Waynesville Police Sergeant Paige Shell was about to give up hope of getting better. The daily drip of violence, death and misery from almost 20 years in law enforcement had left a mark. Her sleep was poor, depression was a stubborn companion, and thoughts of suicide had taken root. Shell, who works in a rural community about 30 miles west of Asheville, tried talk therapy, but it didn't work. When her counsellor suggested ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, she was sceptical. I didn't know what to expect. I'm a cop. It's a trust thing, she said with a thin smile. Combining psychotherapy with low-dose ketamine, a hallucinogenic drug long used as an anesthetic, is a relatively new approach to treating severe depression and post-traumatic stress, especially in populations with high trauma rates such as firefighters, police officers and military members. Yet evidence of the efficacy and safety of ketamine for treatment of mental health conditions is still evolving, and the market remains widely unregulated. First responders experience a disproportionately high burden of trauma and are often left without a lot of treatment options, said Signe Goldman, a psychiatrist and co-owner of Concierge Medicine and Psychiatry in Asheville, who began including ketamine in psychotherapy sessions in 2017. Law enforcement officers in the US, on average, are exposed to 189 traumatic events over their careers, a small study suggests, compared with 2 to 3 in an average adult's lifetime. Research shows that rates of depression and burnout are significantly higher among police officers than in the civilian population, and in recent years, more officers have died by suicide than been killed in the line of duty, according to the First Responder Advocacy Group First Help. Ketamine is a dissociative drug, meaning it causes people to feel detached from their body, physical environment, thoughts, or emotions. The Food and Drug Administration approved it as an anesthetic in 1970. It became a popular party drug in the 1990s, and in 1999, ketamine was added to the list of Schedule 3 non-narcotic substances under the Controlled Substances Act. The death of Friends actor Matthew Perry in 2023, which was attributed to ketamine use, further tainted the drug's reputation. But starting with a 1990 animal study and followed by a landmark human trial, research has shown that low doses of ketamine can also rapidly reduce symptoms of depression. In 2019, the FDA approved esketamine, derived from ketamine and administered as a nasal spray, for treatment of resistant depression. All other forms of ketamine remain FDA approved only for anesthesia. If used to treat psychiatric disorders, it must be prescribed off-label. This is a situation where the clinical practice is probably ahead of the evidence to support it, said John Crystal, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine and a pioneer of ketamine research. Crystal has studied the effect of ketamine on veterans and active duty military members, a population comparable to first responders in their exposure to trauma. While research shows strong evidence of ketamine's antidepressant effects, he said further studies are needed on its potential role in PTSD treatment. The regulatory environment for ketamine also remains a concern, Crystal said. State oversight varies, and federal regulations don't outline dosing, administration methods, safety protocols, or training for providers. In this regulatory patchwork, more than 1,000 ketamine clinics have sprung up across the country. At-home ketamine treatments have flooded the market, prompting the FDA to issue a warning. Side effects of ketamine can range from nausea and blood pressure spikes to suppressed breathing. The drug can also cause adverse psychological effects. Being on a psychedelic puts people in an extremely vulnerable state, Goldman said. People can get re-traumatized as they relive disturbing memories. That's why it's critical that a mental health provider guide a person through a ketamine session, she said. Stripping away armor. With proper precautions and when other treatments have failed, Rick Baker thinks ketamine-assisted psychotherapy is a good fit for first responders. Baker is CEO and founder of Responder Support Services, which provides mental health treatment exclusively to police officers, firefighters, and other first responders in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee. As a population, first responders are more resistant than civilians to traditional therapy, said Baker, who is a licensed clinical mental health counselor. Ketamine provides a potential shortcut into the trauma memory and works like an accelerant to psychotherapy, he said. It strips away people's armor. When used for mental health treatment, a dose of ketamine, typically half a milligram per kilogram of body weight, less than for anesthesia, creates a mildly altered state of consciousness, Goldman said. It makes people look at their own traumatic memories at a distance and tolerate them differently, she said. The ketamine sessions in her practice are usually 2 hours long and clients are under the drug for about 45 minutes. The drug is administered as an IV drip, an intramuscular injection under the tongue lozenges or a compounded nasal spray. The drug is short-acting, meaning its dissociative effects largely wear off within about an hour. But most insurers won't pick up the cost of ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, which can be more than $1,000 per session for the IV drip. That's certainly prohibitive for first responders, Goldman said. The Department of Veterans Affairs covers some forms of ketamine treatment, including ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, for eligible veterans on a case-by-case basis. Over the edge. In Shell's case, a donation made to Responder Support Services covered what her insurance wouldn't when she decided this spring to try ketamine-assisted psychotherapy with Baker, her counsellor. Revisiting the most gruesome calls in her nearly two decades as a police officer was not something Shell wanted to do. But Hurricane Helene, which caused catastrophic flooding in western North Carolina last year, pushed the 41-year-old over the edge, she said. Some of the sessions were rough, said Shell, who is also a member of her agency's SWAT team. Things came up that I didn't want to think about, that I'd buried during my entire career. The badly mangled victim in a fatal car crash, a murder-suicide in which a man cut his pregnant girl's throat, then slit his own. Under ketamine, the images came to life as still pictures, she said, like a surreal slideshow replaying some of her darkest memories. Then I would sit there and cry like a baby. As of early October, Shell had undergone 12 ketamine sessions. They have not provided a sudden, miraculous cure, she said, but her sleep has improved and bad days are now bad moments. She also finds it easier to manage stress, and I smile more than I used to, she said. She was hesitant to share her experience within her department because of the ongoing stigma associated with seeking help in the hard-charging police culture. I just didn't want my people to think I couldn't handle the job, she said. I didn't want them to feel that I'm posing a risk to them. The perception of ketamine plays a role as well, said Sherry Martin, National Director of Wellness Services at the Fraternal Order of the Police, an organisation representing more than 377,000 sworn law enforcement officers. Many cops are used to ketamine as an illegal street drug, she said, or think of it as a counterculture psychedelic. So when they are supposed to accept this as a treatment, that's hard for them to grasp, she said. Few, if any, police departments provide clear guidance on ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. If it were medically prescribed, it would likely be viewed the same as taking an antidepressant, Martin said. Shell ultimately shared her story with colleagues, most of whom were curious and supportive, and she now encourages other officers to speak up about their struggles. She believes seeking mental health treatment, in her case, ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, has made her a better and safer police officer. It's hard to help other people when you can't take care of yourself, she said. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our two articles from the Assembly today about the sales tax and about the use of ketamine for mental health in first responders. We've run out of time for any more articles from the Assembly, but we hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, and if you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.